I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Barack Obama told the Today Show this morning that former Secretary of State Colin Powell won't be campaigning for him, but will advise him. What to make of Powell's endorsement of Obama yesterday? Will it sway undecided voters? And what does it say, if anything, about the once vaunted unity of the conservative movement? John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and political writer for The New York Times. And John, a new Zogby poll from Sunday showed McCain cutting into Obama's lead with independents. But, of course, that was before Powell's endorsement on Meet the Press. Do we have any sense of how that endorsement is resonating?
Well, certainly it allows Barack Obama to dominate the news cycle for at least 24 hours. It has for the last 24, and maybe part of today, too, because we're talking about it. I think it's a reflection of the angst within the Republican Party and adds to the difficulty of John McCain in trying to close this gap in the polls over the last 2 weeks. The only candidate who's come from this far behind this late in a presidential campaign to win the White House was Ronald Reagan in 1980. It's a tall order for John McCain.
Well, and Ronald Reagan's being referenced. More on that in a second. But let's talk about what Colin Powell had to say about the Republican Party. He was strongly critical of the conflation of Muslims with terrorists in some campaigning. Let's listen to two excerpts.
It is permitted to be said such things as, well, you know that Mr. Obama is a Muslim. Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian. But the really right answer is, what if he is? Is there something wrong with being a Muslim in this country? The answer is no, that's not America. Is there something wrong with some 7-year-old Muslim American kid believing that he or she could be president? Yet I have heard senior members of my own party drop this suggestion. He's a Muslim and he might be associated with terrorists. This is not the way we should be doing it in America.
Powell also talked about a photograph he'd seen of a mother mourning at the Arlington National Cemetery grave of her 20-year-old son who died in Iraq.
And then at the very top of the headstone, it didn't have a Christian cross. It didn't have a Star of David. It had a crescent and a star of the Islamic faith. And his name was Karim Rashad Sultan Khan. And he was an American. He was born in New Jersey. He was 14 years old at the time of 9/11. And he waited until he can go serve his country, and he gave his life. Now, we have got to stop polarizing ourselves in this way.
John, conservative columnist David Brooks said the conservative movement is embroiled in debate to go back to the core Ronald Reagan principles or onto something else. Put Colin Powell's statements in context. Is this part of the debate?
Well, it is part of the debate, and one of the questions always for a political party, especially when its fortunes begin to dip, is do you reinforce those things that have made the party unique in the past, that have provided its energy and drive, or do you try to find something new? And Colin Powell is saying that conservative base is spinning an ever tighter web of self-isolation, if you will, that makes it more difficult for them to reach out to moderate Republicans and independents. And I think his defection is a symptom of that, and it's a symptom of some of the searching that's going to go on within the Republican Party if Barack Obama holds this lead and wins the election.
Well, some might say that, you know, Colin Powell has always been, though, more center than to the right in the party. But there have been other conservative endorsements of Obama. Last week, talk radio host Michael Smirkonish, the Chicago Tribune, Christopher Buckley, son of National Review magazine founder William F. Buckley. You know, David Brooks, goes on to speculate about what this split is, and others have as well, a lot of writing over the weekend, that it might be between the elite pundits and the backers of Sarah Palin, the people who she refers to as the Joe six-pack voters and now Joe the plumber voters.
Yes, and David Brooks has also described Sarah Palin as a cancer on the Republican Party for the reasons that you just explained. Another point that Colin Powell made in the Meet the Press interview yesterday was that it's not only small towns in America that have values. This is Colin Powell of New York speaking. This is one of the things that we've seen in the last few days. Palin, other spokespeople for the McCain campaign, have talked about a distinction between sort of the real America versus the more densely populated places like Northern Virginia. This is playing a culture card that is of questionable value in a campaign that is now driven by the economy. And that's the turf on which Barack Obama has built his advantage, and Colin Powell represents one of those people saying, hey, culture wars are not the way for Republicans to turn around. And you're right, Robin. Colin Powell was never part of the conservative base. But what happens when a party is in difficult straits is people on the edges of its coalition begin to flake off. And that's what we're seeing with Powell, what we're seeing in some of the comments by others, Chris Buckley and Michael Smirkanish and others who are defecting.
Well, and we should say conservative William Kristol is sort of dismissing the hand-wringing within the party about what's been called the new vulgarization in American politics. He says now part of this is the failure of the McCain campaign to make its case effectively.
Well, the McCain campaign certainly has failed so far to make its case effectively, but that doesn't mean that Bill Kristol, who has been a big fan of the Palin pick, is right that that was a wise thing politically. It has fired up the conservative base, but you've got to look at what's happened over the last several weeks, especially as the economic crisis became the dominant story of the campaign, and have to wonder whether someone with her background, experience, and thematic emphasis is the right partner for John McCain.
And very briefly, Colin Powell's statements, is this also about reshaping his own legacy? His reputation was tarnished when he was sent to the UN with false evidence of WMDs by the Bush administration.
I do think that's part of it, Robin. Look, Colin Powell did not leave with a good taste in his mouth from the Bush administration. He's been critical of the way a national security business was conducted. I think he feels a little bit burned by the way he was employed by the Bush administration to make a case that he later discovered not to be correct. And so, yes, I do think Colin Powell is somebody with a keen political radar and sees himself watching a ticket, Democratic ticket, that's got a substantial lead and is lining up accordingly.
John Harwood, Chief Washington Correspondent for CNBC, political writer for The New York Times. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, there's one issue, at least on the face of things, that the presidential candidates seem to agree on more often than not, and that's the environment. Both oppose drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife, although Sarah Palin supports it, and she says she's working on McCain to change his mind. Both presidential candidates see ethanol as a way to wean the country off foreign oil, although McCain is against ethanol subsidies. Both Obama and McCain support offshore oil drilling, Obama reluctantly, as we'll hear. And both believe man is partly to blame for climate change, and both support legislation to curb it, but they differ on what to do. Well, we've asked Margaret Criz to explain the often subtle differences in the candidates' stance on energy and the environment. That's her beat for the National Journal. She joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. Margie, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with climate change. As we said, both Obama and McCain say the U.S. needs to take a leadership role in global negotiations to cut emissions, that Congress needs to take concrete action. But you write that McCain embraces market-based approaches, Obama favors federal mandates, and this is a fundamental difference that underlies all of their environmental positions. So tell us more about that.
Well, they both agree that we should have a kind of a cap-and-trade program that puts a limit on the amount of global warming emissions that are released into the atmosphere. But just how you go about encouraging people to cut those emissions is going to be different. McCain suggests that you can do it kind of by saying, here it is, this is the limit, you guys figure out how to do it.
Well, and McCain would do this by sort of distributing these credits free of charge to polluting companies. And then, as you said, they can use those credits and trade them among themselves?
Yeah, he would auction them. He would go to the marketplace and say, okay, from now on, if you want to emit any kind of a greenhouse gas, then you have to buy a credit for each ton of greenhouse gas that you emit. Well, that means that it's going to be more expensive to have a coal-fired power plant or to have a factory that emits a lot of pollution.
So Obama would almost fine polluters by saying you have to buy these credits if you're going to pollute. McCain would have companies trade them. So if there's a company that doesn't want to revamp the company and wants to continue polluting, they'd have to buy credits from another company that has cut down on their emissions, and so they'd pay in that way.
Right. But, you know, both of them are talking about a trading program. It's just how you distribute these credits that's important. And, you know, a lot of that is being discussed in Congress as well. And you can see that they're kind of coming to a compromise on that at this point. Congress is going to be the one that decides the real details of this. But the fact that you have two candidates, a Republican and Democratic candidate, who are saying, let's cut emissions in a mandatory program by the federal government, that's brand new.
Keeping with the cap and trade, is there any evidence to show that one approach is more effective than another?
Well, It's hard to say because we haven't actually had any kind of mandatory program for cutting pollution. We have had various voluntary programs to cut carbon dioxide in the past. It happened under Clinton. What Bush is doing is the same way. And we've never really been able to cut the emissions to any remarkable point.
Well, what about the international community, which has been highly critical of the Bush administration's approach to climate change? Some climate negotiators saying that any international agreement to cut emissions to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which runs out in 2012, is on hold while they wait for the next administration to take office. Do they like what they're hearing from either McCain or Obama?
I think if you talk to them on the sidelines, certainly not publicly, they would say that they would prefer the approach that Obama has taken because that's a little bit more similar to what the Europeans are talking about in a broad sense of the way. But I know that either one, if you have a mandatory program by the United States first time, they would be thrilled to know that the United States was willing to do something, to specify what they're willing to do and to put it on paper. So I think they're looking for the next administration, no matter who it is.
Well, let's look at nuclear power. Both candidates saying it's one of a number of options in cutting carbon emissions and reducing global warming. But what's their difference?
Well, McCain wants to build 45 new nuclear power plants by 2030, which even the nuclear engineers I talk to say that that's virtually impossible because there just aren't even the plants to build the structures involved with these nuclear power plants, which would probably require a lot of federal government money in order to do that.
And a lot of engineers. We just reported on that recently. What does Obama, what does Obama want to do?
Well, Obama says that he doesn't want to close off the nuclear option. And remember, Obama comes from Illinois. Illinois has 11 nuclear power plants, and he recognizes the value of nuclear power. But on the other hand, he has said, well, we don't know where we're going to put our waste at this point. And until we figure that out, he's kind of pulling in. Part of it's also that he has a lot of supporters on the left who do not like nuclear power at all.
So Obama's saying hold off until the industry can find a safe way to dispose of commercial nuclear waste. And speaking of which, how do the candidates feel on the use of Nevada's Yucca Mountain as a place to dump radioactive waste?
Well, Obama has said that it hasn't been proven to be safe. McCain over time has had different opinions on it, but overall he says that he would support the use of the Yucca Mountain. He's also talking about an international repository for waste or trying to reprocess the waste. That's expensive and it is unproven that it could be done at this point. So it's sort of a long-term pie-in-the-sky kind of approach to it. But McCain is also saying, well, in the meantime, Yucca doesn't look so bad.
Well, we should say, I mean, it may be pie in the sky, but it does sound like somebody's got to think of a way to store commercial radioactive waste. And, you know, McCain is saying an international repository, perhaps that, you know, down the road might be something.
It's a very expensive and complicated international kind of proposal. You're right, it could be an answer down the road. But at this point, you know, it's not going to happen in the next administration. Let's just put it that way.
That's Margaret Criz of the National Journal. Her beat is energy and the environment. We're going to have more later today. And you thought you were going to retire. What's it like to compete for a job in your 70s? Also, a Wall Street psychologist who's gotten pretty busy lately. Back in a minute, here and now. We are back with more on where the presidential candidates stand on the energy and environment issues with Margaret Criz. She reports on those issues for the National Journal. And Margie, before the break, we were talking about how Barack Obama and John McCain have taken somewhat similar stands when it comes to climate change and nuclear power. Another issue on which they seem to agree on paper is oil exploration. Now, when gas prices soared this year, both men reversed their earlier positions and came out in support of gas and oil drilling off U.S. shores. McCain much more vigorously, we remember, drill, baby, drill. But Obama, with a caveat, he's using his support for drilling as political leverage?
Exactly. He said he would support some kind of a drilling proposal, but only if it meant that you could get the votes to do everything else he'd like to do with his energy plan. So it was not a wholehearted drill, baby, drill kind of approach at all. And, you know, I think what would happen is once you got in, either of them got into office, they would be pushing either the drill, baby, drill, or else with Obama, he would say, let's hold off. Let's see what else we can do in the meantime.
And what are some of the things that each suggests outside of drilling?
Well, I mean, that's where we get into this whole question of mandates versus non-mandates. Obama wants to require cars to go further on gasoline, on a tank of gasoline. They're both talking about alternative fuels. They're both talking about ethanol, although McCain doesn't like the idea of mandates, and Obama does. He is from a corn state of Illinois.
Well, Margie, environmentalists cheered McCain when he opposed oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It was seen as an example of McCain, you know, not walking lockstep with George Bush. But now we have his choice of Sarah Palin as running mate. She is skeptical that climate change is caused by humans. She favors drilling in the Arctic Refuge. She had that famous wink in the debate, saying that she's working on John McCain to get him to change his mind on that. So, you know, how is he viewed by the environmentally conscious?
Well, you know, he was the first one to put together a piece of legislation on climate change. In 2003, he and Lieberman put together the McCain-Lieberman bill, which was the first big, let's go after climate change problems piece of legislation. Got a lot of criticism for it. At that point, both the League of Conservation Voters and the Sierra Club, two big political arms of the environmental community, both endorsed him for reelection. So McCain was riding high. And, you know, he is a true supporter on the climate change front, but there's a lot of questions about his other votes. He has been nearly absent for any kind of environment or sort of green energy bill being voted on in Congress, in this Congress these last 2 years. The environmentalists much prefer Obama, and they are much more supportive of his proposals. When it comes to things like ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and drilling in there, that is universally supported by anybody from Alaska, Democrat or Republican. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to understand that were Palin to be the vice president, and were we to have another round of really high oil prices, you could see she might have more leverage. So they're scared.
But you mentioned how, you know, environmentalists might turn to Barack Obama, but he raised more than a few eyebrows when he came out in support of new technologies to convert coal to oil. Opponents say the production would create more global warming gases than even oil does. So why is he in favor of that?
Well, he's in favor of that, well, number one, because there's a lot of coal in southern Illinois, and he is the senator from southern Illinois, mm-hmm. or from Illinois, but also because that is something that the military would like. It's an easy source of oil if you can take coal and make it into oil. But what he's come out with and has calmed the nerves of the environmental community on it is to say, I will only support coal to oil if there is some sort of a carbon standard so that you can take the carbon dioxide that comes from that whole process of making oil and insert it into the ground and cap it and keep it there.
This is Margie Criz. She covers the environment and energy issues for the National Journal. Thoroughly and terrifically, we might add. And I just want to ask one last thing about the two candidates. Just about their personalities. John McCain is passionate about the Grand Canyon, we know that, but he's also spent most of his life in the military or in Congress. Meanwhile, Barack Obama spent most of his life in the city of Chicago. Is there anything about either man that has either been a moment when their views were crystallized on the environment or has shaped their views of the environment, or is that not where they come at these issues?
I don't think they come at the issues that way. I think they both come at it in a more of an economic point of view. There was something about McCain that got him to believe in climate change. I know that he took a lot of tours up into the northern reaches of Greenland and Alaska and various other places that have made him see that there's impacts already starting to affect humans on climate change. And he's taken a lot of other people there with him, other senators, including Hillary Clinton, for a matter of fact. But there was nothing that suddenly said, oh, my God, this is the most important issue in my life. They've all treated it as part of the whole. In some ways, you might think of that as the next generation of environmentalists. It's part of their entire picture of what the world should be.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, how much do you think the fact of, you know, what we're seeing with the economy will move the environment further and further onto that back? It may be a sizzling, globally warmed burner, but it's going to be moved back because of the economy.
Well, that's one of the interesting things. And some people in Congress, and certainly Barack Obama, has already started to rephrase that climate change issue by saying it's a green jobs issue. If we address climate change, we're going to create a lot more jobs. It's new technologies for wind and solar and new things that we haven't even created yet. And so they're trying to push the economics side of climate change and say, we can do better, and this is how we can do better. And therefore, not only will we create jobs, but they won't be the dirty old jobs. They'll be the brand new green jobs. So it's a very interesting approach. I've seen some of that with McCain, but he's still linked in with coal and oil in a much stronger way, and nuclear, whereas the Democrats are starting to talk about it as sort of this new generation of jobs.
Right. And maybe, thereby not scare people off who might think, geez, we can't take care of the environment now.
Exactly.
We don't have any money. That's Margaret Chris. She writes about the environment and energy for the National Journal. And starting today, she'll be asking experts for their opinions on these issues and how they pertain to the presidential race in a National Journal blog. To get to it, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Margie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, with Election Day 2 weeks away, we're going to look at the history of voting in America. You used to have to bring your own ballot and fight your way to the polls, and it was considered cowardly not to make your vote public. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, OMG, is text messaging killing language? A leading linguist says no. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The downturn in the economy has forced many older workers to rethink their retirement plans. Many who put money away for their golden years saw those funds take quite a beating in recent weeks. And then there are people who didn't have savings. They just can't afford to retire. A recent U.S. Census survey found that older workers are participating more than ever before in the workforce. Right now, one out of every eight workers is over 65. By 2030, it'll be one in five. Economists say this is a good thing because there aren't enough people to replace retiring baby boomers. But is this always a good thing for the older workers? We sent Here Now's Monica Brady Meyer off to talk with some of them and hear how they're weathering the storm on Wall Street.
I'm here with John Harris, professor of economics at Boston University, and I'm visiting you during your office hours today. You're 74 years old and you work part-time. When did you go to a part-time schedule and why?
I think it was about 7 years ago. Now I'm starting to lose track. But my wife's also an academic. She teaches Irish history at Boston College. And we found ourselves teaching full-time during a full year. We both have overseas projects. I work a lot in Africa and Southeast Asia. She works in Ireland. And we have 8 grandkids, and we wanted a little bit of flexibility. And we realized, we thought through, it was time we could have retired. But we really didn't want to give up anything.
In the current economic turmoil, how will you change your work situation? Are you considering going back to full-time work or cutting back on travel? What ways are you thinking about changing the way you work?
Yeah, actually, we were just talking. We're probably going to cut back a little bit on travel.
What about your economic situation in terms of your 401k? Have you looked at it recently? Are you concerned about when you'll be able to retire fully? Or whether you'll have to put that off. Right now you're working voluntarily, but there must be a date in your mind, an age in your mind, when you'll want to stay home full time.
At the moment, there's no necessity on it. What we've done is sort of planned what we've got, and what the financial advisor says is, at the rate we're going and what we plan, make sure we don't outlive our resources. So the last time we could probably make it to 104 before we quite ran out. I expect now we're going to have to finish at about 88.
You've lost that much in your retirement?
Yeah, but I was surprised how much. I just usually I check about every 6 months. Diversify your holdings and let it be. And this is going to run out. But it's been the main part of the 401 is down by about 25% this year.
Do you ever feel like you should be getting out of the way for one of these 32-year-old newly minted PhDs to take over in your place?
Well, the way it goes, I'm basically at half a salary. So I'm relatively cheap from the standpoint of the university.
Thank you so much, John Harris, professor of economics at Boston University, and good luck.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Not everyone who is still working is happy about it. I met Sue Rummel in her apartment in a suburb north of Boston.
Pillows, accessories, I have tablecloth, things that I'm working on. It runs the gamut.
She's 61 and a self-employed custom drape maker. Her job is physically demanding, as she does all of the cutting, sewing, and hanging of the curtains herself.
The dream would be, you know, like my parents, you know, my father retired at 62. They moved to Florida, lived in a beautiful home. But that dream of, you know, being able to enjoy my senior years, if not the way they did, you know, in some fashion similar to that. I don't know now. I really don't know what's going to happen.
In fact, when Rummel turns 62 next year, she won't move to Florida. She'll keep working and start collecting Social Security, even though she'll be penalized for drawing on the fund at an early age. She's pleased Social Security just increased its benefits by nearly 6%, because she says an additional $60 from Social Security will help cover an electric bill.
I can't necessarily rely on either the economy to keep me going in a regular job to be completely financially, you know, comfortable. I'm going to need that assist from Social Security, and physically, because the job is very demanding. We joke about me carrying a toolbox and a ladder and hanging drapes at 90.
I'm just going to run down, Glenn, and get some food. I'll be right back.
At the Neshoba Valley Medical Center, Camille Provost works part-time as a medical transporter. At 69 years old, she's on her feet most of the day, moving patients, medical records, and specimens around the small hospital in a town west of Boston. Camille says working in a hospital is new for her.
I started off as a hairdresser many years back in the late 60s, early 70s, and I worked at home, had my own business because I had four children to bring up, so I had my business in my home. So I worked there many years until my husband unexpectedly died.
That's okay. That means you're being paged to go
yes,
do something, right?
Is. Yes.
Can I hold you here a little longer?
Oh, yes. My husband died in 86, so in 86 I took over his business, which was developing and building.
Was there any economic necessity for you to go back to work?
Not at the time. It's sort of, you know, I was getting worried about things. I got to be truthful. And I'm kind of glad I got the job because with the economy the way it is now, yes, I could use it. I have to be truthful about it. Yeah. It did play a part.
Do you ever wake up in the morning and say, I'm too old for this, pushing around patients, carrying papers from here to there. I should be at home watching TV with a hot cup of coffee.
You want the truth on that one?
Oh, yes.
Nope.
No, really?
Not really. I'm not a real stay-at-home person. I really need to be active. I feel good when I'm active.
Well, in this current economic situation, how do you think you're going to change your work situation? Are you considering going back full-time, cutting back on travel, or how is it affecting you?
Well, I have cut back on travel because I used to take off a lot on the weekends with friends and that, and we think twice about it. And if I do it, I'm doing it with friends so we can pool together and, you know, pay half and half on the gas or whatever it takes, you know. But yes, I've cut down quite a bit. Entertainment, yeah. And the working this job turned out good for me.
And how long do you see yourself working? When do you think part-time work will become too much?
I hope never. But I'm looking probably in my 75 years old, you know, maybe by then I might be ready to sit down and maybe do some knitting. Not now.
Well, thank you very much, Camille Provost.
You're welcome.
That report from Here and Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. And some notes from related news today. The UN announced that the global financial crisis will add at least 20 million people to the world's unemployment rolls. The U.S. unemployment rate is now at 6.1%, and some predictors indicate it could hit 7.5% by next year. Well, two ongoing stories today could contribute to a jump. There's speculation still that a deal is in the works for General Motors to buy Chrysler. If the automakers merge, analysts estimate that more than half of Chrysler's 66,000 employees would lose their jobs. Workers from GM could be affected as well. And today, Merrill Lynch's CEO said Bank of America's takeover of his firm will likely cause thousands of layoffs, mostly in information technology. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, maybe it's unemployment or tumbling stocks, but according to a new AP Yahoo News poll, the number of people who say they're happy about their lives is way down, from 70% last month to 59% today. One wonders if any Wall Street executives were polled. Of course, there can be serious emotional consequences when anyone loses money, but we were struck in a recent article on the Daily Beast website with the tact one psychologist takes in dealing with top executives who've lost millions. Dr. Stephen Josephson is a clinical psychologist and professor at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. And Dr. Josephson, yours is not your traditional soothing talk therapy.
I think that when you're dealing with Wall Street people who generally have come up through the ranks, often being athletes and being kind of tough guys, somewhat macho, I don't think that they respond all that well to simple empathy. I don't think they want to hear about, you know, oh, so you'll lose your money, that's okay.
So you're tough with them.
Right.
What is it you have to do? Like, what role do you take on? What do you say?
I think that, in my experience, they do best with kind of like the boxer who just got punched and the coach has him in the corner between rounds and he rubs his neck and then he says, get back in there and, you know, beat him up.
You pretty much say,
Grow up, girly.
Grow up, girly. That's mild. You say to them, would you, you know, if you had a friend in this situation, would you tell them to throw in the freaking towel?
Look, this is all pushing them to move away from these pessimistic interpretations and trying to get them to realize, you know, so you're losing some money at this time. It's not the end of the world. Trying to get them to decatastrophize and, in some sense, get them back into the game.
Well, by saying, get off your GD butt and make some money.
Well, the rule of thumb is you use the language of the person when they come in. So if they say GD, you say GD. This is the language of Wall Street.
Do you towel snap them, you know, like in a locker room?
Not yet, but I may get there soon.
But, you know, but some would say, you know, doctor, this might be a great opportunity.
Right.
To say to these guys, hey, let's look at
your values.
You know, your values. And, you know, maybe it's an opportunity to reexamine how you treated other people to climb to the top.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, it's about timing. And I think that people are receptive to certain information at certain time. The first thing is to get them back on their feet and get out of the panic zone.
Because do you really think that some of your clients, and you see 80 people a week.
Yeah, it's out of control.
That was before the crisis.
Yes, but it's, you know, now there's a waiting list every day to come in.
I mean, is one of the reasons that you talk to them in their words and just kind of, you know, keep them motivated as opposed to trying to maybe change them in the moment? Do you think that some of these people are suicidal?
Well, you always look for that. You ask about, it has to do with the perception of the future. If you think that your problems are permanent and that they're never going to change, then in fact hopelessness is the norm. That's the best, I guess, predictor of suicidality. And when people express suicidality to loved ones or, you know, professionals, obviously the first thing that you do, you call 911. Let them spend the night in the hospital being evaluated, being observed, because we can prevent suicide, mm-hmm. Not always, but much of the time.
And most of the time, it sounds like with your clients, it's not that. It's being a trash-talking drill sergeant.
Something like that. It's part of that toughness, which, you know, again, is I'm on your side. You can do this. You know what to do. I don't have to teach you how to make money.
Dr. Stephen Josephson, clinical psychologist and professor at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York. By the way, is part of the concern of some of these top executives when they come to see you that they know how the country feels about them right now? Or is it more about just, you know, them and what they've lost? Or is it part of it, you know, shame or being thought ill of?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When you talk to hedge funders who were, you know, short-selling things like Lehman Brothers, the response I got from one individual was, they were going to go down anyway. We may have expedited the process. So people have developed all sorts of rationalizations. I don't think they feel that guilty, to be honest with you. I think it's more of a narcissistic injury that they were richer at one point than they are now, and it's humiliating within the community if other people have lost less, kind of thing.
Jeez. Most people would be on the couch out of sheer shame that they injured another.
Not this crew.
Oh, dear. Dr. Josephson, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
And staying with people it's hard to have sympathy for, our Boston Red Sox lost to the Tampa Bay Rays last night. The Rays now go on to their first World Series. They'll be facing the Philadelphia Phillies beginning this Wednesday at Tropicana Field. Best of luck to all. The 7-time World Series champion Red Sox go back to an old familiar chant. Wait till next year. And unlike past decades, this time we really believe it. Back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. The first text message was sent in 1992, but no one ever thought text messaging would ever grow. Isn't that funny? I mean, LOL. Today, over 900 billion text messages are sent every year. Some call it slanguage or a digital virus because vowels are missing, so is punctuation, and numbers appear. Don't you just hate that? H8. Well, no. In Japan, text messaging is a literary form. People compose and read novels on their cell phones, and teenagers love it, even if some scholars worry they may not know that love is spelled with an O and an E. Or before is not spelled with the letter B in the number 4. This debate has caught the attention of linguist David Crystal. He's the author of many books, including the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language and Words, Words, Words. Most recently, though, he's taken on the language of texting in a tidy little book called Texting, T-X-T-I-N-G, The Great Debate, G-R-8. DB8, and he joins us from his home studio in Wales. Now, you've written the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language. Do you think this is a new language?
No, it's not a new language as such. I know people get the impression from all the abbreviations and everything that something very new is going on here. But when you actually look at all the messages that get sent, do you know, less than 10% of the words that are in texts actually are abbreviated. And although the kids are doing it quite a lot, when adults text to each other, they don't abbreviate much at all. And remember that most texts out in cyberspace these days are between adults, between organizations and adults. The Stock Exchange telling its people about the latest stocks. Barack Obama telling his troops about what's going on. Universities telling people, beware, there's a storm coming up, and so don't come in today. The kids, of course, are coming along and want to think this is really cool stuff, and so they introduce these abbreviations, but even they don't use them that much, because if you abbreviate everything, your message quickly becomes unintelligible.
Well, you include two comments in the book. John Humphreys of the Daily Mail wrote that texters are vandals, doing to our language what Genghis Khan did to his neighbors 800 years ago. And John Sutherland writes in The Guardian that texting is bleak, bald, sad shorthand, which masks dyslexia, poor spelling, and mental laziness. Yikes.
Wow, yes, that was strong, wasn't it? But you know, it's a moral panic that has no basis in fact. People think that texting is full of abbreviations. No, it isn't. People think that these abbreviations are new. They're not new. Abbreviations like C for C and U for U, they've been around for decades, for 100 years. Queen Victoria, used to play games abbreviating words in this way. She certainly did things like C and U, but there are very few new ones in this style.
These single word, C for S-E-E, texts are called rebuses, we understand, and as you say, they go back quite a ways.
They go well back. I mean, you can get rebuses right back in Egyptian hieroglyphics, but in English, the term comes into the language in the 17th century and became really quite a playful way of expressing things. I don't know whether you ever had games like this in the States, but in the UK, you used to get these Christmas books, full of cartoon characters and so on. And these annuals would often have a puzzle. And do you know this one, Robin? If I were to put before you a capital Y...
I'm going to ask people to just get their pens out because we'll want people to write this down. So go ahead.
So write down a Y, mm-hmm. another capital Y, a letter U, mm-hmm. a letter R, mm-hmm. another Y, another Y, another U, and another B, mm-hmm. then a letter I, and then a letter C, and then a letter U, and a letter R, and then another Y, and then another Y, and then number 4, mm-hmm. and then the word me. And that used to be a sort of puzzle in books, you see, and you had to work it out by reading it like this. Two Ys you are, two Ys you be, I see you are, two Ys for me.
I love that.
And that goes back 100 years, you see. So there isn't that much new about texting from that point of view, is there?
You also write that IOU is from 1618,
sure.
This isn't new. Remind us, for those who haven't text messaged lately, remind us of what some of the words are. I mean, we mentioned LOL, laugh out loud, and 8 for, H8 would be hate. But what are some others?
Well, the abbreviations are not as important as you might think. I mean, we can certainly list lots of them, like BRB, be right back, and all languages do them. In German, for instance, somebody might write Gute Nacht, Nacht for night, meaning N with an 8 after it, you see, because Acht is 8 in German. Now, different languages use these things in different ways. And interestingly, you start to find dialects of text messaging emerging then.
Well, and also you talk about France. How is texting used in France?
Well, see, in a place like France, where if you're on a French train or in a French bus, to speak loudly into a telephone to somebody else is really frowned upon quite a lot. And so therefore text messaging there is an ideal solution.
Well, another thing that's happening, we understand that the abbreviated text messaging started because the early cell phones had some rudimentary technology. We all know, if you still have, as I do, the keypads that have three or four letters on each number, you have to press in to get the letter. And it was easier to just shorten some of the words than try to spell words that way. But now cell phones have text software that if you hit a letter, it will remember the word. You know, you don't have to spell out a whole word. So people are less likely to abbreviate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's so difficult to predict the future in this sort of game, isn't it? You know, 10 years ago, one could hardly have predicted this. And in 10 years' time, what will have happened to text messaging? It may be just, you know, an effect of the moment, more or less.
Really?
Yeah, given that the technology is developing so rapidly, there may not be such pressure on to abbreviate as there was in the past. But, you know, there is an important thing about abbreviation, and that is, you know, a lot of people find it very, very cool way of communicating. And so they start to play with it and to develop all sorts of creative uses, which are actually quite tricky to put into the text message sometimes. You know, I remember noticing when the thing first came out in the UK, people would have text messaging poetry competitions, you know, write a poem within 160 characters. It's a bit like Japanese haikus in a way, you know, the discipline makes you really think more sharply and you can produce some stunning stuff.
I'm looking at a poem from Norman Silver, the first couple of words. Language, L-A-N-G-W-I-J, is highly infectious, H-I-L-Y.
Yeah.
Children the world over, O-V-A, catch it from parents, P-A-R-E-N-C-E, by word of mouth.
What's happened here is that a text poet like Norman Silver, having seen the sorts of abbreviations that are used in cell phones, then decides to set up a whole published genre in a book in which they're all used. So he uses actually quite long poems in his book. Mm. And the same point applies to the Japanese novels that you were mentioning earlier on. Although they started on cell phones and people would send a chapter a day down to the phone user, now, of course, a lot of these things have been published as books.
So do you think, I mean, is it a problem, though, that young people in particular may be growing up thinking that the letters N and E spell A-N-Y, any? Or
no, because in order to do that, you must already know what the normal spelling is. You see, you can't leave letters out of words unless you know they're there in the first place. Hmm. Now, people are concerned about literacy standards these days. And one of the big things about literacy is people are always saying the more you read and the more you write, the better your literacy is going to be. Now, texting is a perfect example where you can read and write, sometimes abbreviated, sometimes not. And the more you read and write, do you know what the results are showing? The better your literacy scores. And it isn't surprising, really, when you think that kids are getting far more experience of literacy using their cell phone than they might ever have had before.
Linguist David Crystal, Honorary Professor of Linguistics at the University of Wales, also a prolific author himself, most recently Texting the Great Debate, GR8DB8. Professor, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for your interest.